Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is a lively conversation originally recorded in 1992 between Dr. Walter Williams, Professor of Economics at George Mason University, Dr. William Stahl, Chairman of the Economics Department at Temple University, and Dr. William Dunkelberg, Dean of the School of Business and Management at Temple University. We hope you enjoy today's podcast, and don't forget to subscribe to get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Welcome to the campus of Temple University in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I think we have a very interesting discussion today, the role of government in a free enterprise society. Certainly lots of very interesting issues, lots of complications, and lots of controversy. And to help us sort through some of these issues, I have with us today two very distinguished professors of economics. On my immediate right, Walter Williams, the Olin Professor of Economics at George Mason University. And to his right, Bill Stahl, who is the chairman of the economics department at Temple University. I'm Bill Dunkelberg, and I'm the dean of the School of Business and Management at Temple. I think you'll find we have a lively discussion, and it ought to be very interesting, and hopefully we'll come to some conclusions, but if not, we'll certainly leave you with some interesting questions to think about. Let me start by saying a little bit about the role of government in the United States. We find that today, government spending accounts for about one quarter of our output in the economy. In very simple terms, about one out of every $4 that gets spent is spent by government. So government is taking a lot of goods and services from the economy. Beyond that, the budget is much larger than that, since a lot of what government does is to collect money from some individuals and pass it on to other individuals, the so-called transfer function. So that today we're looking at a government budget in terms of total money moving of well over $1 trillion, close to $1.5 trillion. There's also a much larger reach of government into the private sector through the regulatory process. Government is continually passing laws, rules, mandates, and regulations, which impact how our businesses can function and, of course, how we run our own lives and what we have to do each day. So the reach of government has become very pervasive. The main issue in elections in the United States really comes down to, in my opinion, how big government should be and what kinds of things government should be doing and shouldn't be doing. And that's what we're going to talk about today. Why don't we begin with a fairly simple discussion about what the conceptual role of government is, say, in terms of what the Constitution has to say to us about what government's supposed to do. I remember memorizing parts of the Constitution when I was young, and there were terms in it like promote the general welfare, provide for the common defense, and I think secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves, that is today, and our posterity, and that raises the issue of this debt that we might have to pay off in the future that our children have to deal with. What do you think? What should be the fundamental guidelines for what government should be doing and shouldn't be doing in our free society?
Well, I kind of go back to a first principle, and the first principle was enunciated by John Locke, who played a great role in influencing the founding fathers in writing the Constitution, and that is, each of us own ourselves. That is, we own ourselves. It's wrong for somebody to own another person. Now, if you agree that each of us owns ourselves, well, you also have to agree that in order to make self-ownership meaningful, then you must own what you produce. That is, if someone else, for example, owned 100% of what you produce, you'd be merely a slave. Now, it turns out that the average American works from January 1st until May 8th to pay federal, state, and local taxes. That is, somebody else decides how close to 5 months the fruits of his labor is used. I think that, and a lot of that is not for things that people use. That is, if you look at the federal budget, 2/3 of federal expenditures constitute an activity where the government, through intimidation, threats, and coercion, confiscates the property that belongs to one American and gives it to another American to whom it does not belong. I think that is an immoral function of government.
And Tax Freedom Day gets later every year, right? So every year we seem to be working longer for somebody else. And we have no choice in this. If you don't pay your taxes, you get into trouble. Bill?
Well, I come at this from a little different perspective. I agree with everything Walter says to the extent that we do have a system that's based on individual responsibility. But individuals work together and we're part of a community. And people have responsibility not only to themselves, but also to their community. And this responsibility is reflected in their responsibility to participate in government and to pay taxes to support that government. So I do not believe that there is, you can take an extreme position on this point. And it's really a matter of a balance. That is, there are certain things that the government does, and there are certain things that the private sector does. And we have to decide on a case-by-case basis which area should be addressing which problem at which particular time. It's very hard to be dogmatic about, in my judgment.
Well, I think it's a little more than that, I believe. That is, we have to ask ourselves, can one make a moral case for confiscating the property that belongs to one person and giving it to another to whom it does not belong? Can you make a moral case? Because after all, that's what thieves do. That is, they confiscate the property of one person, or economists call it income redistribution. That's right. What thieves that's what they and do. They do
that's,
that too.
That's right.
But can we? I think there's a basic question. Can one make a moral case, or is it constitutionally authorized for the government to take that which belongs to one person and give it to another to whom it does not belong? I'm saying, like, I mean, to put it in concrete, that is, where the government takes your earnings and gives it to a farmer, or gives it to an Egyptian, or gives it to somebody else.
Well, let's start off with a few concrete examples. Let's take one that's always been very controversial, still controversial today, and that's defense spending. And the so-called peace dividend. Historically, we've seen defense spending be as large as 15% of total gross national product, or total gross output, or total income, however you want to measure it. We've seen it as low as, say, 4.5% in Carter's last year. We saw Mr. Reagan take it back up to about 6.5% of gross national product, that is 6% of what we produce and earn. And now, of course, we have the end of the Cold War, the peace dividend. We see defense spending running back down, and we argue about what we should do with that dividend if we haven't already spent it. But is that an appropriate item for the government to steal from you a little bit of money to make sure that we can provide that kind of service?
I mean, this, I think, is one area in which all economists and almost all citizens would agree. This goes back to the very beginnings of our discipline in economics. Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations talked about the need for a national defense and the need for taxes to support that national defense. But there's, of course, a great debate as to the scope of the expenditure. Different reasonable humans will come to different opinions as to the size of the defense sector.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. That is, if there's a legitimate function of government,
it is to protect
you and I from international thugs who would confiscate our property.
And national thugs.
And domestic thugs.
Domestic thugs, right.
That would confiscate
our
property.
That's exactly right.
Now, so what one says, you know, I believe Thomas Paine said, he said that government under the best of circumstances is a necessary evil. And so it means that, well, in order for government to do these minimalist functions, you do have to tax. But I'm not talking about taxing to pay for things that I use or that you and I use. I'm saying taxing to take our money to give it to farmers.
For redistribution purposes or subsidy purposes. The thing is, the constitutional issue has been settled. I mean, obviously we have it and the Constitution has allowed it. And in a free society, people decide what they want their government to do. And one of the things that our society has decided over the years is it wants a certain amount of income redistribution. I mean, the fundamental principle in a free society should be that people should decide what it is they want their government to do. And they have settled this question, I'd say, generally, though not in the specifics that you speak.
Well, certainly even producing income redistribution is costly. Since we've been talking about taxes, I think we probably ought to point out that taxes are negative incentives. Anything you tax, you are going to get less of. So Right. If you tax work or saving or driving too fast with tickets, which we like to tax speeding, or we try to, whatever you tax, you're going to get less of, and of course, whatever you subsidize, if you have a negative tax on it, you're going to get more of. And that is an issue of redistribution, in the sense that if we're going to take money from Walter and give it to you, Bill, we have to tax him, and tax him at a different rate, obviously, than we're going to tax you. And he's wondering why we should do that. Why is that an appropriate function for government? And do we have a right to do that?
You see, I feel there's two different issues that you're raising. One is the moral question, which is what Walter's been focusing on, and also the incentive question about, will this tax, increased tax on Walter Williams, reduce his work effort or his savings? Now, I happen to know Walter Williams, and that will not happen. Walter worked just exactly as hard, whether that his tax rate is high or low. So it depends. We do have to have taxes, and the incentive issues have to be addressed. But our job is really to find those places in the economy where the incentive effects will be minimized.
Well, see, I'm going to part company a little bit with the democratic approach. That is, Frederick Bastiat wrote a little book called The Law. He's a 17th century French philosopher. And he gave us a test to decide whether government was doing something immoral or illegitimate. And he said, ask yourself the question, if I did the same thing individually, would I be condemned as a criminal? That is, for example, I could see some elderly lady sleeping out on the grate downtown Philadelphia, and I could walk up to either you or Bill, and I could come up to you with a gun, and I could say, give me your $200. Then, having gotten your $200, I could go down and help the lady, get her some housing. And yeah. Now, would I be guilty of a crime? Yes, I would. Now, I'd be guilty of behaving immorally. Now, does an immoral act all of a sudden become a moral act because there's a consensus? That is, just because a majority goes for it. Mm-hmm. See, I disagree. I say that just because we vote for something does not establish its morality. And that's what we're trying, that's what the framers were trying to look for. They were asking, give us a government that's moral. And you find no constitutional authority for two-thirds of what our federal government is doing. The courts have ruled it constitutional, mm-hmm. but it's not in the Constitution. I've looked carefully.
And in fact, one of the major concerns that the government had in framing the Constitution was the tyranny of the majority, to protect the rights of minority groups and to make sure that the majority is always asking the moral question. Is this really right? Just because most of us want to vote for it because maybe we benefit from it. And that's certainly a very, very interesting issue. Well, one of those transfers that's taking place, I mean, we do have subsidies to farmers and subsidies to the housing industry, for example.
College students.
We have a lot of subsidies that are built into the federal system. And we another big transfer that's been taking place that we have to raise taxes for that's become very controversial, and that is interest on the debt. And the deficit, certainly the deficit has become one of the major issues in the last decade or so. When President Reagan took over in 1980, the total national debt was, the federal debt was under $1 trillion. Now we're looking at roughly $4 trillion. Interest on the debt has become the second largest item in the government's budget, and that's simply to pay that interest, we simply have to tax people $250 billion every year, and that's a growing number, in order to send that money to whoever happens to be holding government bonds. How do we like that picture in terms of what government should be up to?
I feel the federal government's in a major quandary. That the point that you make is very valid about the debt and the interest. On the other hand, in my judgment, the macro economy of the country has not been operating at anywhere near capacity in recent years. The most recent data that I was just looking at in Dr. Dunkelberg's office indicates that we're still sputtering along, and there may be a genuine need for the new president to pursue a more expansionary fiscal policy, which may of necessity mean an increase in the deficit. And it may be what I'm saying is that there may be more important issues facing the American people than just the matter of the deficit and how much interest we pay on it.
Of course, in early 1990, we employed a record high percentage of the population, I think 63.1%. Never has a high percentage of our people been employed before. We had a record high percentage of the population with two jobs. We were certainly fully employed. We couldn't have, if more jobs had been demanded, we couldn't staff them. Right. We'd hired everybody we could get to work.
Right.
And yet the deficit was hundreds of billions of dollars at that point in time. So certainly the economy was fully utilized at that time, and yet there we were running these amazing deficits.
Well, it was not because of revenues. We were engaging in bread and circuses, that we were just spending, and we will never get the deficit under control until we find out what to do with spending. Now, let's look at the record. I mean, within the last 30 years, we've had one balanced budget, I believe in 1969 mm-hmm. or 68. Now, in 1974, we had the Budget Control Act that was supposed to get the deficit under hand. In 1978, we had the Balanced Budget Act, which made balanced budget the law of the land. Then, of course, we all remember the Graham-Rudman Act that was supposed to get the deficit down to zero by 1992. And then we remember the 1986 the largest tax increase in U.S. history at the time, which was called the down payment on the deficit. Then we had the 1990 budget deal that was supposed to have the five-year deficit reduce it, the $500 billion five-year deficit reduce it to zero, and instead it's over a trillion now. Now, and all this time, taxes have been going up. We'll never deal with the deficit until we can get government back into the bottle. That is to get the federal government doing its constitutionally authorized functions.
Don't you think this all is tied to a very unrealistic view of the electorate? I mean, I feel that the electorate is largely to blame for this, in the sense that we are a nation of people who want the government to do something for us, and we want someone else to pay for it. And this idea just is pervasive in the society, and it makes it very difficult for the elected representatives of the electorate to deal with the problem that you described.
Oh, you're 100% correct. That is, Americans are getting exactly what we're asking for.
Right.
That is,
want something for nothing.
We can't blame politicians, because politicians are merely doing what Americans tell them to do. And what do Americans tell politicians to do? They say, we're going to elect you to the Senate or to the state legislature to use the power of your office to confiscate the property that belongs to one American and
give
bring it,
to
it
us.
Back.
Bring it home. Exactly right.
Well, that certainly is the major problem. If you look at the last calendar year budget for the government, you'll find that spending rose something like 10%, while revenues rose maybe 3% because of the weak economy. So it's incredible, and there are a lot of people who suggest we should have some rules really to regulate government spending, that government spending is really the best measure of taxation, because the government spending and the regulations measure what the government gloms onto and takes away from us, and they finance that with taxes and by borrowing. Mm-hmm. So if we were to curb government spending and just leave the tax law in place, as good or bad as it may be, we would in fact bring the budget into balance. So the issue does seem to be really getting government spending under control.
Mm-hmm. But let me suggest to you that Americans tend to think of themselves as being in a society in which the taxes are very high and there's a very heavy hand of government. But in fact, if you make some international comparisons, you'll see that that is really not the case, that compared to most of our competitors that are developed, our government sector is not particularly large, and that we are not particularly overtaxed. And indeed, if you look at the trends in tax revenues over time, Americans are not really in the tax burden that's falling on a typical American, if you combine state and local taxes, has not really increased all that much. So in many respects, these concerns seem to me a little bit exaggerated when you put them into a temporal and spatial context.
Well, I don't know. I don't know whether temporal, because at the turn of the century in 1902,
right,
the average American paid $60 a year in federal,
right,
state and local taxes.
Right.
And in fact, they worked, I think, something like not quite a month. But one of the reasons why, you know, if you say, look, our taxes are much lower than the rest of the world, industrialized nation. Well, no wonder the rest of the world wants to buy America. Mm-hmm. That is, they want to, they're rushing to bring their capital over here.
Right.
They're willing to invest in America because we have a more robust economy as a result of the lower tax rate. So I'm not willing to say, look, let's be like Sweden, or let's be like West Germany. I'm not willing. I would say let's be like Japan, maybe.
Well, I think that, you know, that in that perspective, one could view the Eastern European countries as one in which the tax rate is like 100%, and that everything was owned by the government. All the decisions were made by the government, and of course that collapsed very badly. And then we have the kind of lower tax kinds of economies like a Hong Kong or so on that get very exciting. Mm-hmm. And I think that is really the issue. And I think that's the concern that people have, is not that, well, we could pay more taxes. And I guess if we wanted to pay them, that is, if we were paying them for something that we were happy about buying, then we'd have even a different effect. But right now, the real issue is, and again, the one we're talking about, how big should government be? A lot of us feel we're paying taxes and we're not getting
anything in value in return.
Right. And that, of course, I think creates the incentive problem and the whole issue of confiscation. And
that's right. To go into debt, for our nation to go into debt to fight World War II, nobody can object to that. I mean, that was an essential task, and it made future generations better off. It was an investment.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Today, we're going into debt, and it's just for bread and circuses. It's for today's consumption. There's no cash flow coming back from it.
I think that problem has become real obvious, say, with our roads and bridges problem and the infrastructure. If a private company built a bridge, it could borrow, say, 20-year money to finance a bridge that would last 20 years, but then it would create a sinking fund. That is, every year it would put money into a bank account so that in 20 years when the bridge fell down, it'd have enough money to put the bridge back up and keep the business running. Government builds the bridge, borrows the money for 20 years, never puts the money away. Now the bridges are falling down and we have no money. It was used up every year. We never put the money away. And now we face some very serious problems with the infrastructure. And that kind of behavior, I think, we are concerned about.
You would agree with that, Walter, that represents an investment, that line of expenditure. And possibly education represents an investment. And those, therefore, would be legitimate functions for government.
Maybe. Absolutely. but see, there's a problem with government that we should pay attention to. Look, a politician in 1992, he is not going to undertake large costs in 1992 for something that's going to benefit the nation in 2005. He's just going to be run out of office. Now, however, a business executive, even if he only has one more year left with the company, he would make a costly investment today if there was a large payoff 10 years from now. Why? Because they're capital markets in business. That is, it would be that is, if the market agreed that this today's expenditure would be reap great benefits in the future, it would show up in the share values. Now that's the problem in government. That is, there's no connection, there's no discounting process whereby a politician can meaningfully do something today that might be very costly, such as privatize Social Security, when there are huge benefits in the future. He'll say, "Well, let the guy in 2020 worry about it."
But there have been counterexamples. I mean, there was the interstate highway system, for example, in the 50s, which had a tremendous impact on the development of the nation. That was a long-term project, and it was done through the political sector. And I don't see any reason why we couldn't do something like that again, you know, today.
Well, every once in a while, we get surprised by Congress. We get leadership instead of representation.
Well, that's right. But I think...
Bill, you're right on that. You're right on that. But that was at a time when government was not doing all the things it's doing now, right?
You're maybe saying that there's been a shift in the focus of government from what it ought to be doing to what it ought not to be doing. And I guess I would kind of agree with that in a lot of ways. That the focus, to me, I don't think that shrinking the government is the right approach, but rather to refocus on those things that will make us a more productive society. And I think there are things that government does that will accomplish that.
Mm-hmm. That raises the issue of free trade, which is an interesting question as well. We have this thing called the European Community coming up, which, in my opinion, what the nations of Europe are trying to do is to look like us. We have 50 possible countries, and if you think about those countries all trying to be self-sufficient with different currencies and different governments and border guards, we would be less of a nation if we had that kind of a system We have a situation which, because of the problems in Florida, unemployed construction workers can move from Michigan and get a job, but it's not clear the Germans will let the Italians come in. And that's certainly a source of our strength, and yet we're very concerned about having open borders when we start talking about Canada and Mexico and so on. Where should we be on that? That's a very important issue in terms of government's role here.
Well, first, I don't think countries trade with each other. That is, people trade with each other. That is, there's some guy, Harry Happy in Canada, that wants to sell Walter Williams a car. It doesn't have anything to do with Washington, or it doesn't have anything to do with Ottawa. It's people that are in trading. And so I say that for a person like myself that respects individual liberty, that is, people ought to be able to engage in peaceable, voluntary exchange without third-party interferences. And so I would be against any kind of trade barrier.
So if Harry wants to sell you a car, and then Washington decides to put a 100% tariff on the car, making it more expensive for you to get the car and tougher for Harry to sell it,
yeah,
you have a problem with that.
That's right. It's just like, you know, Washington says, look, it says, you hear Bush say, or David Duke this time, he said that, well, the Japanese, they don't let our rice come in their country from Louisiana. And so the Japanese people are paying four times the world price for rice.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And so we say, well, we're going to retaliate by putting tariffs on their cars or whatever. And in a sense, what they're saying, since Japanese government doesn't give their citizens freedom, we're going to deny it to American citizens. That is, we're going to get even with Japan. We're going to make Americans pay four times the world price
or twice the world price for sugar or what?
French wines.
That's right.
Five times as much for French wines.
That's right. It's like you and I are in a boat. We're at ocean. And so you shoot an end in your, you shoot a hole in your part of your boat. And what's my response? Am I supposed to shoot a hole in my part? It's sort of nonsense.
So in principle, it looks like we have agreement amongst the three of us, which may be an unusual event, that free trade is a great idea. Of course, once you start implementing it, but we have the problem with interest groups and how we deal with that and government's response to interest groups. Any quick comments on how we should be worrying about things all the way from PACs to lobbying to...
Term limits, perhaps.
Term limits.
Well, there certainly could be some... reforms of the way in which campaigns are financed, which would allow our representatives to be less tied to these interest groups. Now, that the problem with that is many of these proposals require public funding for campaigns, which many people would disagree with. But I think it is conceivable that we could reform our system in such a way as to make our representatives less beholden to these special interests.
Well, I have a problem with that in the following sense. I think I agree with you, but I would say, well, why should any American, regardless of any group, why should he be able to have the right to rig the rules of the game in his favor? That is, why should, what is moral about sugar producers in Louisiana being able to go to Washington and tell Congress, keep out Caribbean sugar? Don't allow Americans to buy Caribbean sugar so that I can charge a higher price. That appears to me to be clearly immoral. And it just shouldn't be. You shouldn't have to. You let the sugar industry create some kind of pact, you know, to play cards with one another or form any kind of association that they want. But they should not have this kind of power. It's because we say that it's okay to have that kind of power. That's the problem.
Well, I would disagree. I mean, you're certainly preaching to the converted here with regard to the overall attitude toward this group. But my interest in this is more operational. What would we do to change it? There must be something in the structure of American politics which gives these interest groups, particularly these agricultural groups, this very unusual power to subsidize themselves at our expense. And I just can't believe there isn't some sort of reform that would be possible to remedy this.
To make them more sensitive to being long-term planners, which we talked about. I mean, it is true that that the day after the election, everybody starts running for re-election. And when it comes to thinking about policies for the economy, We don't get long-term thinking. Anybody who's in Congress wants to do something that brings gain today and probably will bring pain tomorrow because it's not the smartest thing to do. But tomorrow I may or may not be here, but I have to have gain today if I have any chance of being back here in 2 years. And I think that is a problem. What we may need really is a set of policies which give us some pain today because they give us gain tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. And yet it is hard to figure out exactly how we get our representatives to give us the leadership, I guess, to get those kinds of that kind of government. That seems to be lacking.
Well, I've suggested in Congress on several occasions that instead of having tariffs on foreign sugar coming to this country, that it's said to cost Americans $3 billion in higher sugar prices. Instead of having a tariff or a quota on foreign sugar, why don't we just create an Aid to Dependent Sugar Producers
yes.
Act and just vote on whether to give them $3 billion?
It's a lot simpler, wouldn't it?
It's a lot simpler, and it probably would not be done.
Yeah.
That's right. We probably would object to doing a lot of what's really done in our name and on our behalf with our money, which is if we really could tie those together, we wouldn't accept the confiscation that you talk about.
That's right. And we wouldn't accept if we could see the prices, if we could see the cost. You know, like, for example, it's easy for Americans to say, let's have a voluntary restraints on foreign cars because we save jobs in Detroit. Well, yeah, those are the visible beneficiaries, but the victims of it are all those people that, let's say, you ask the question, what would the Japanese person done with the $10,000? Well, he might have bought some wheat, or he might have bought some wood, he might buy AT&T stock. Well, those victims are invisible.
It's very hard to tell that you paid for all this stuff.
That's right.
That's right. And there's no question, if you have a lower price for anything, it leaves you with more money to spend on something else. And that, of course, goes for defense. If we actually wind the defense industry down and put the tax dollars that we took to finance it back in the hands of the private sector, we'll spend it on something else. Well, speaking of that, let me make a transition here into another very interesting issue that we hear politicians talking a lot about these days, and that is job creation. We have two fundamental views, apparently, about job creation. We hear people running for office talking about government job creation, which some of us, including myself, would view as an oxymoron. And then we have private sector job creation. In the first instance, if you want government job creation, I think that implies an expanding role of government, more government spending, bigger government budgets, more government projects. Those who are opposed to that would suggest that the way to create jobs is to get government to back off and provide more resources to the private sector, where you and I as consumers get to decide what we want and where the jobs will be. Where are we going to come out on that? We have high unemployment, and we are concerned about solving it. It's alleged the private sector can't solve this problem. Where should government be doing here?
Well, I think you put your finger on a very fundamental issue, Bill, because if you look, as Walter has pointed out, to the role of government in the U.S. economy since World War II, we have run deficits every year. And by and large, the effect of those deficits has been stimulatory. That is, the economy has been pushed to a higher level of production than would have been the case if the budget had been balanced. This history and also our recent experience is suggesting to me in certain ways that maybe the private economy can't by itself operate at close to full employment, in which case that would require, if we as Americans feel that we should have full employment, that would require the government to step in and pursue an old-fashioned Keynesian stimulus program, possibly consisting of public spending, public jobs, possibly consisting of lower taxes or some combination of the two. And I think this is a real deep fundamental issue that the new administration is certainly going to have to address.
Are you saying that we would be much better off if we had a $1 trillion deficit instead of a $400 billion?
Well, I guess I'm saying is that it seems to be a very uncomfortable trade-off that seems to be looming, one of which is we could pursue an expansionary policy which would push the economy closer to full employment, but that would certainly have the effect of increasing the deficit with the attendant negative elements that might go along with that. But what I'm wondering is, as a is this the dilemma that the economy is presenting to us?
Well, I worry about people saying that government creating jobs, because, I mean, that says that out there is a tooth fairy or a Santa Claus giving the government the money. That is, I want to know, that is, if the government creates one job, let's say a $20,000 a year job, where in the world is it going to get the money for to do that?
But if we're not producing at capacity, then you get GNP or GDP gets larger.
So you can pay for
the job and pay for the taxes and have something left
no,
over.
No, I'm just trying to say, well, where does that $20,000, that is...
You mean initially, in the initial situation?
Yeah, I want to see, I want to know where it comes from. That is, is there a tooth fairy or Santa Claus giving the money? It clearly it doesn't come from outer space.
In the 80s, it was the Japanese and the Germans.
So it has to come from somewhere. And we have to ask, well, if the government spends that $20,000, it has to obtain that $20,000, and how is it going to obtain that $20,000, and what effect does it have on the economy of obtaining that $20,000? I mean, for example, with the gasoline tax, the nickel a gallon gasoline tax, well, clearly, it created more jobs on the highway, but, and road construction, but I'm asking, well, what jobs did it destroy? I mean, maybe the guy at the 7-Eleven shop that used to fill up your car with gas, and you went over and get a hot dog, and so the gasoline's more, and so you can't get the hot dog anymore. And so the guy says to this guy, well, you have to go. I have to lay you off because there's not as many people buying these other things. So what government does, it appears that government can shift unemployment. It can shift it from one sector to another sector. But the question is whether it can, in fact, make a job. This is a real question.
What happened in 1940?
We mean what happened?
Well,
we created jobs. We sent them.
We went from a slack economy to a full employment economy in a very short period of time, driven by an increase in government spending.
Well, we sent a lot of guys. We gave them. We created big jobs over fighting Japan and Germany. Clearly, we did that.
But outside of that, I think that in the long haul, one has to ask oneself, if this job is created, if I have to tax Walter $20,000 to hire you to do something, in fact, do we really get net job creation? And also, do we like what you're doing? I mean, the government creates this job and you're doing something, but Walter would have spent the $20,000 and created a job someplace else. So we may have lost in the long haul one job for the job we created through
Or a job and a half.
Is that the right thing to do?
See, to me, it's something you can't be dogmatic about. It's very easy for tenured faculty members, who do not have to worry about losing their job, to speak along these lines. But there is some tendency in the U.S. economy to generate significant rates of unemployment. And as a strictly practical matter, the electorate is not going to put up with this. And the question is, how far down, do we go before the electorate responds? But there does seem to be some tendency, and it seems to me idiotic to be dogmatic about the role of government when the economy has this manifest tendency. Well, at some point, we're going to have to, may have to do something
about it. I can be dogmatic about the role of government because I'm not a politician. I can be absolutely honest.
That's true. You're not going to be ever unemployed either. I mean, that's the other thing.
No, matter of fact, by the way, mention a tenure. I offered to sell my tenure, but nobody would buy it.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly the unemployment issue is an important one. Now, some of the Eastern European countries had no unemployment that we could see, but they certainly were all underemployed, and they produced very little for themselves, and of course those systems collapsed, and so even though there were a lot of government jobs in those systems, they obviously weren't worth anything.
Well, it was disguised. In the Soviet Union, I think that's a clear case where it was disguised, that is, unemployment was disguised. That is, they were just paying people to be unproductive, which is the same as unemployment compensation.
Exactly. But they pretend to pay us and we pretend to
work,
I think was the way that was.
They spent their time standing in line, right? They go to work, check in, and then get in the line at the butcher shop.
Mm-hmm. Certainly that's one of the big issues that we have to resolve here in the U.S. economy in terms of government's role. And do we get real job creation? And what kind of value do we get for our buck when we look at these kinds of issues? Well, we've talked about a lot of very complicated issues for government and even said a few words about the process of getting our decisions, communicated to those who are up there deciding how to spend our money. One of the fun ones that we haven't mentioned that has this long-term consideration is Social Security. As you now, as you may remember, we had a problem with Social Security in that we were paying out more than we took in. We suddenly discovered that Social Security is not a big bank account, that as fast as we pay it in, it's paid out. We had the Greenspan Commission that said, well, there's two ways to fix it, cut benefits or raise taxes, and they didn't want to cut benefits, so they raised taxes. And in fact, right now, the Social Security tax is generating more revenue than we're paying out. So it has a surplus right now in the system, and we're accumulating it. And estimates are that, say, by the year 2010, we will have accumulated, say, $2 trillion in surplus, or $3 trillion. Let's pick some number like that. By law, this surplus has to be invested in government securities. I love this. Now, let's go to the year 2010 and assume we have $3 trillion. What is that, an asset? Is $3 trillion in government debt an asset? My view is that the only way we get our Social Security then is if they sell those bonds to the kids, which means they have to give up their money, or they tax our kids to retire those bonds and give us the money. I think we're being had here. What do you think about this?
Well, I agree with that, actually. And there's sort of a narrow media question about what's happening in the Social Security system right now, and then a larger question of whether we really even ought to have it in the first place. I think that this is one area where I think I'm inclined to agree with what I think Walter's position is with respect to this, and that this may have been a program that maybe made a little bit of sense in the 30s when it started and has now kind of gotten out of control, and there are other private sector alternatives that would perhaps be better, but it's very difficult to conceive of how we would get to those.
Well, I think it's very hard to get to the privatization, but each year we postpone finding a solution, it's going to be more and more burdensome. According to reliable estimates, and you can correct me on this, it's by the year 2030, if we pay the same level of benefits that we're paying today, the Social Security tax is going to have to be around 32 or 34% because of the demographic changes that are occurring in the economy. Right. And one has asked, well, will those people in 2030, will they be willing to tax themselves 30 to 32% to take care of some older people? And I believe that there's a real potential of Social Security causing age conflict in our society, that is turning young people against older people.
I think it's already happened to some extent.
Mm-hmm. And then Social Security is a bad deal. That is, if you put the same amount of money into a private retirement fund, you would be able to, the median income worker would be able to retire off of $48,000 a year, and then when he died, be able to bequeath to his children $250,000. I think it's a bad deal, and it's a Ponzi scheme. Mm-hmm. It's an illegal Ponzi scheme.
And of course, it's the problem is beyond 2 years, and so we have a hard time getting our representatives to focus in on that problem. I think when the system started, there were something like 17 payers per recipient of Social Security payments, and then we look into the past the year 2000, it's down to like 3 to 1 or something. So the tax burden will be incredibly high in some form. Our kids will have to buy the bonds and not spend the money on their homes,
or they'll pay the taxes.
Or they're going to pay taxes, and it is going to create an incredible problem, and yet we can't seem to get any attention focused on
it. And we have to get the information out to America. A lot of people who are receiving Social Security, they think that the checks coming out are their own checks.
Right.
But they don't know that people who are retired today receiving Social Security, they get all that they ever put in the system in 5 or 6 years. A young person entering the workforce today, he's going to have to live until he's 96 to break even with the system.
That's right.
It's a bad deal. We need to change it.
Well, gentlemen, on this very uncertain note, I'm going to have to tell you that we're out of time. We certainly raised a lot of very important issues today, and I'm not sure we gave all the answers, since the answers are very hard answers. But I think we did come up with a few interesting things that we all have to be concerned about. One is we have to find a way to get those who represent us in this government sector, which is about a third of our economy, to pay more attention to the long run, to find out what it is we really need to make this country great, and to try to think in terms of what we should do to make that happen for us, and try to get them less focused on being reelected. So I thank you all for joining us. I hope you found the discussion as interesting as we obviously did. Thanks again, and stay tuned.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.